This is Audible.
Spycraft, the secret history of the CIA's spy techs from communism to Al-Qaeda. By Robert Wallace and H. Keith Melton, with Henry Robert Schlesinger. Narrated by David Drummond. Copyright 2008 by Robert Wallace, H. Keith Melton, and Henry R. Schlesinger. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Dutton Books, a member of Penguin Group USA Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2008 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Foreword by George J. Tenet, Director, Central Intelligence, 1997 to 2004. Minutes before I was to deliver the keynote speech at CIA headquarters, recognizing the 50th anniversary of the Office of Technical Service, OTS, on September 7, 2001, I was unavoidably called away to a meeting downtown. What I had prepared to say to the several hundred OTS officers gathered that morning would seem prescient 96 hours later when Al-Qaeda struck the American homeland. Those words remain appropriate today as our nation confronts terrorism on every continent. For five decades, OTS officers and their wondrous devices had played a vital role in virtually every major CIA clandestine operation. In the words of Jim Pavitt, our deputy director for operations during my tenure, OTS was the technical problem solver for what appears impossible. CIA's Office of Technical Service was established in 1951 at the beginning of the Cold War to meet a threat very different from the one America faces today. Throughout the next 50 years, OTS fashioned a history of adapting brilliantly to the challenge of applying new technology to the intelligence needs of each era. Whether CIA operations required an ultra-miniature camera, a battery the size of a fingernail, or travel documents with unique inks and printing, OTS became the organization that did not just make magic, it made magic on demand. In 1951, the future of the United States and Western democracy was confronted by an ideology of advancing communism sponsored by a nuclear-armed Soviet Union. In those uncertain times, leaders of the four-year-old CIA, DCI Walter Beadle Smith, his deputy Alan Dulles, and a promising operations officer, Richard Helms, envisioned technology as the means to secure a decisive intelligence advantage over the Soviet Union and its client states. Drawing on their collective World War II experiences in the Office of Strategic Services, they concluded that the best operations were a partnership between technical specialists and operations officers. The concept they enacted was simple and brilliant. CIA would apply the full force of America's technological ingenuity, whether sponsored by government or industry, to solve the problems of clandestine operations. From that idea, the technical services staff emerged, and its successes became legendary. Now, some of the previously untold stories of the impact on our intelligence history by this remarkable collection of people and technology can be told. Every CIA director confronts the tension between secrecy and the American public's right to know what its government is doing. Secrets are the necessary currency of the intelligence profession, and protection of confidential sources and special methods is a solemn duty of every CIA officer. Regrettably, there have been instances when secrecy was invoked to deny knowledge of information that has long since lost sensitivity but is vital for public understanding and consideration. Such misuse of secrecy can result in flawed policy decisions, wild speculation about the CIA's activities, and a misleading historical record. For the CIA to maintain the public trust, responsible and accurate presentation of information on intelligence subjects is both wise and necessary. The thousands of books and news articles produced about the CIA's operations have generally concentrated on large technical programs, such as the U-2 spy plane, satellites, and communications intercepts, or spies who worked for the CIA or against American interests. In spy episodes, the technical equipment, an essential element of agent operations, is often obscured by the drama and action surrounding the human characters. Little attention had been given to the technological origins of the gadgets or the people who made them. Spycraft now presents this well-told story in a long-overdue tribute to the previously unrecognized contributions to U.S. intelligence of an eclectic, talented collection of scientists, engineers, craftsmen, artists, and technicians. Spycraft is a history of the CIA's fusion of technical innovation with classical tradecraft, and equally, a call to young men and women with similar talents to enlist in the battle against America's new enemies. The authors of Spycraft have been my associates and friends for many years. Together, they bring a career of operational experience and a lifetime of study of intelligence to this work. During my tenure as DCI, Robert Wallace headed the Office of Technical Service after serving more than 25 years as an agency operations officer and manager. Throughout his 32-year career, he received multiple awards for operational success and leadership. H. Keith Melton has been a friend of the CIA for more than two decades. He is a frequent lecturer throughout the intelligence community, a best-selling author, and an internationally recognized collector and interpreter of historical intelligence technical devices and artifacts. My draft of September 7, 2001 remarks concluded with the observation that the 21st century will present major challenges to our agency, and OTS ingenuity will be put to the test in the years ahead. The test began 4 days later. In the months that followed 9/11, the CIA again turned to OTS for technical innovation to build the gadgets that would detect and defeat a different and deadly enemy operating in an information environment revolutionized by the Internet and digital technology. Spycraft, whether detailing Cold War operations or those directed against terrorists, offers a somber warning to our adversaries and fresh encouragement to those who cherish freedom that we will prevail. Preface. The CIA's new Deputy Director for Operations, David Cohen, called me to his office in August 1995. "I want you to apply for the job of Deputy Director, Office of Technical Service, in the DS&T, Directorate of Science and Technology," Cohen directed. "We need a DO, Directorate of Operations, person there, and I think you're a good candidate." He might as well have suggested that I apply for NASA's astronaut program. I'd been an operations officer for almost 25 years, but for the past 18 months, I was assigned to the comptroller's office. At age 51, I was out of operations, doing the type of staff and budget work that motivated me to plan for early retirement. "I've never worked in the DS&T. I'm a history political science major, an operations type. I'm an analog guy in a digital world. I don't even change the oil in my car," I objected. "I know what your skills are, and this is a good assignment for you." Cohen left no doubt about the answer he wanted. "Okay, I'll apply, but I can't imagine I'll be competitive if there are other candidates." "There'll be other candidates, and you'll do fine. We need a DO officer in OTS who knows senior ops people and is someone I have confidence in. You've been looking at the budgets in every DO division almost 2 years, so you know the key players and they know you. I have to make sure technical service and operations stay linked." The interview was over. I had worked for Cohen several years earlier and recalled his frequent admonition that once a decision was made, he had no patience for further discussion. This was not the first time that he had directed me to a job I had not sought, and the others had worked out pretty well. In 1988, he sent me to a large station that had never been on my assignment wish list. That put me into position to join the ranks of the CIA's Senior Intelligence Service. 3 years later, he ordered me back to headquarters to serve as a division-level resource manager. Since I had spent the previous 18 years in various field stations, this responsibility introduced me to a previously unknown world of billion-dollar budgets and the agency's senior leadership. 6 weeks following the conversation with Cohen, after separate interviews with the executive director, Nora Slatkin, and the Deputy Director for Science and Technology, Dr. Ruth David, both recent appointees to their positions, I became Deputy Director, OTS. Evidently, they agreed with Cohen that the job required a breadth of operational and management experience more than a technical degree. OTS is America's Q, sort of, said Roy, in welcoming me to the office and offering no apology for the reference to the gadget master of James Bond movies. Roy had spent his first 10 years at OTS in the forgery shop, working as a document authenticator, making certain that CIA-produced travel and alias identity documents were flawless in print type, color, design, and paper texture. Now, as a senior staff officer for Robert Manners, the director of OTS, he had drawn the task of providing the new guy with a much-needed Cliff's Notes version of the office. I say sort of, Roy continued, because, unlike the movies, if one of our visas doesn't pass muster at an immigration checkpoint, or one of our concealments accidentally opens and spills its contents, we can't reshoot the scene. If people are arrested or get killed because of our mistakes, they stay in jail for a long time, or they really die. Roy also made it clear that America's Q consisted of not one scientific genius or a handful of eccentric inventors, but a large contingent of technical officers, engineers, scientists, technicians, craftsmen, artists, and social scientists deployed throughout the world and cross-trained in operational tradecraft. OTS had a hand in every aspect of the CIA's spy gear, from design and development through testing, deployment, and maintenance. Now, this is what's really important, Roy said, beginning the comprehensive briefing with a slow, deliberate delivery that conveyed no-nonsense seriousness. We consider ourselves part of the Directorate of Operations as much as a part of the DS&T. Whatever the DO stations and case officers need for technical support, we do everything in our power to deliver. When we go to the field to do a job, there's no question who we work for, the chief of station. Roy explained that the techs did much more than build and deliver spy gear. Usually, we are right there with the case officer or the agent at the user's side in the operation. We train agents, install equipment, test systems, and repair stuff that breaks. We take the same risks as the case officers, share the same emotion of accomplishment or otherwise. Over the course of his career, the tech becomes involved in more operations and meets more agents than many case officers. Roy described OTS's 5 primary organizational elements, or groups, as these were designated. The largest was a covert communications, or COVCOM group, with a name that described its function. This group developed systems for agents and case officers to communicate covertly and securely. Secret writing, short-range radio, sub-miniature cameras, special film, high-frequency broadcasts, satellite communications, and microdots were all included in COVCOM. A second OTS group designed and deployed audio bugs, telephone taps, and visual surveillance systems. These techs were often on the road up to 50% of the time, traveling from country to country as their services were required. The third group, called on for special missions that may include support to paramilitary operations, included a mixture of technical and soft science capabilities. This group produced tracking devices and sensors, conducted weapons training and analysis, analyzed foreign espionage equipment, performed operational psychological assessments, and built special-use batteries. Roy came from a fourth group that made disguises and reproduced documents. Its work in creating counterfeit travel documents could be traced directly back to a predecessor organization in the Office of Strategic Services. Rounding out OTS were the Concealments and Electronics Fabrication Laboratories, known collectively as Station 3, and a field structure with regional bases in South America, Europe, and Asia. Roy's briefing supplemented my prior knowledge of OTS from 2 recent assignments, one operational and the other administrative. For 2 years in the early 1990s, I served as deputy chief for the CIA's non-official cover, NOC, program. There I worked with OTS officers who support NOC officers with documentation, covert communications, disguise, identities, and concealments to assure the NOCs were never identified with the U.S. government. The OTS provided the equipment and documents that enabled NOCs to live a normal life as, say, a businessman, freelance photographer, scientist, or rice merchant while engaging in their clandestine work for the agency. In the comptroller's office, I encountered OTS from the perch of a budget weenie. Beginning in 1991, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the comptroller had the unenviable task of managing a declining CIA budget at a time when operations officers were, in reality, being pressed by demands for new, better, and faster intelligence on counter-proliferation, counter-terrorism, and counter-narcotics. OTS, like other components of the CIA, struggled to absorb the impact of reduced budgets without any reduction in demands for spy gear. For the next 3 years as OTS deputy director or acting director, I would deal firsthand with the damage that the budget cuts of the 1990s did to the CIA's counter-surveillance systems, advanced power sources, technical counterintelligence capabilities, and paramilitary-related weapons and training. Then, beginning in 1999, as new resources began to be available, I would have the opportunity as director to lead OTS in creating and reconstituting capabilities for the 21st century. From its formation in 1951, OTS concentrated its efforts on creating devices and capabilities to improve the CIA's ability to identify, recruit, and securely handle clandestine agents. Whether the operational requirement needed research, development, engineering, production, training, or deployment, OTS responded. Motivated by a philosophy of limitless possibility, a few hundred technical specialists gave American intelligence its decisive technical advantage in the Cold War, a conflict that continues today in the worldwide battle against terrorists. Collectively, the stories that form the OTS history convey a level of dedication and commitment by officers whose pride in their service to America was more important than personal wealth or individual acclaim. At their best, these experiences are models for successive generations of intelligence officers who would apply technology to agent operations. I cannot imagine a more rewarding responsibility or an honor greater than working with this remarkable cadre of technical officers, successors to the rich heritage of OSS General William Donovan and his chief technical genius, New England chemist Stanley Lovell. The genesis of spycraft occurred during an afternoon-long conversation with John Alto, a retired case officer, in San Antonio in February 1999. I had been appointed director of the CIA's Office of Technical Service 3 months earlier. John had joined the CIA in 1950 and spent the next 5 decades in Soviet operations. John took note of my recent appointment and with unexpected seriousness asked, "Do you have any concept of what OTS and its predecessor, the Technical Services Division, accomplished for operations?" Before I could respond, John continued. "I tell you," he began, "it is because of the TECs and TSD that we in Soviet operations eventually won the intelligence war against the KGB in Moscow. And to my knowledge, no one has ever recorded that story, officially or unofficially." Over the next 3 hours, John described a remarkable inventory of TSD devices, technologies, inventions, gadgets, and tricks that he and others used in Moscow and throughout the Iron Curtain countries during the 40-year Cold War. He recounted fascinating tales about the leadership of Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, the cleverness of the TSD engineers, the inventiveness of the field techs, and the determination shared by TDS and Soviet division case officers to break the stranglehold of the KGB on the CIA's operations in Moscow. "You should do something," John urged, "to get this story recorded before all of us who were involved are gone and the inevitable organizational changes at CIA obscure this history." 2 years earlier, I had met H. Keith Melton, a lifelong student of intelligence history and private collector of espionage devices and equipment. Keith lent the agency hundreds of artifacts from his private collection of espionage equipment for display during the CIA's 50th anniversary in 1997. Subsequently, I assisted Keith in transforming the display into a permanent Cold War exhibit in CIA's original headquarters building. On September 7, 2001, OTS celebrated its 50th anniversary with a gala dinner highlighted by Keith's presentation of the International History of Spy Gadgets and Technical Espionage. Shortly after I retired, Keith and I had dinner during one of his visits to Washington. As we shared our admiration of the creativity and courage of the engineers and technical officers whom we had come to know, Keith asked if I had considered writing an account of my tenure as OTS director. I had not, but his question reminded me of John Alto's admonition 4 years earlier, and sparked the idea of writing a public history of OTS from the accounts of retired technical officers. It would be a true espionage story that, combined with Keith's wealth of knowledge and images of historical spy gear, could be a valuable addition to intelligence literature. Keith agreed, and Spycraft was born. We understood the obligations from my CIA employment to submit writing about intelligence subjects to the agency for pre-publication review to preclude the inadvertent release of classified information. I anticipated no particular difficulties with such review. Before beginning the project, I met with the CIA's Publications Review Board, outlined the concept, and received encouragement to proceed. In July 2004, the board approved a detailed outline of a proposed popular account of OTS adventures and contributions to U.S. intelligence, along with the two sample chapters we had submitted. Relying on that approval, we contracted with Dutton, an imprint of Penguin USA, for publication, with full expectation of delivering a properly agency-reviewed manuscript in late 2005. We submitted our 774-page manuscript under the title An Uncommon Service to the board on September 6, 2005. Agency regulations specify manuscripts are to be reviewed within 30 days. After 6 months, on March 13, 2006, the board issued us a letter stating, "Except for chapters 1 through 3, your manuscript is inappropriate for disclosure in the public domain." The agency had approved only the first 34 pages, all of which discussed equipment from the Office of Strategic Service, OSS, World War II inventory. The 740 inappropriate pages included the previously approved detailed outline and sample chapters. No specific classified material was identified. Rather, the agency applied a previously discredited mosaic theory of redaction, contending that a compilation of unclassified information becomes classified when written by someone at my senior level. The board's letter asserted that, in the aggregate, the manuscript provides so much information it would be of immense value to our adversaries. There seemed to be no awareness that adversaries read English and have the same internet access and Google tools we used in our research. During my previous 7 years with OTS, I reviewed several books and articles as part of the agency's pre-publication review process. In preparing this manuscript, I exercised the same conscientious judgment regarding potentially classified information as I had done as a government employee. In its attempt to prevent the authors from publishing Spycraft, the March 2006 letter revealed the agency's apparent unwillingness to distinguish between responsible writing on intelligence subjects and unauthorized leaks of classified information. With the assistance of attorney Mark Zaid, we filed an appeal 2 weeks later. Such appeals, according to agency regulations, would be adjudicated by the CIA's executive director within 30 days of receipt. We received no response to our appeal for 8 months. Mid-level officers of the bureaucracy took no action in what appeared to be an attempt to deny publication by causing an indefinite delay. Faced with the unwillingness of the agency to conduct a review consistent with its pre-publication policies, we prepared to seek relief in federal court. In the opinion of our legal counsel, the agency's refusal to honor its own regulations, coupled with the capricious deletions of unclassified material from the manuscript, constituted a violation of First Amendment constitutional rights. Before taking the legal step, we made a personal request to the CIA's Associate Deputy Director in December 2006 for intervention. As a result, on February 8, 2007, we were advised that another review had reduced objections to approximately 50 of the manuscript's pages. Further, the board offered to reconsider the remaining deletions if the authors could demonstrate the material was not classified. Although we believe none of the disputed material is classified, as an accommodation, we revised certain passages and deleted some terminology that the CIA considered operationally sensitive. On July 18, 2007, we received approval to publish virtually all of the original manuscript. The best that can be said of the experience is that agency management eventually recognized a need to reform its pre-publication policy and repair the broken review process. A historical irony is that William Hood encountered a similarly recalcitrant bureaucracy in 1981 when writing Mole, an account from the 1950s of the Soviet spy Pyotr Popov. "Every word in this manuscript is classified," said the initial CIA review. 25 years later, Mole is now recognized as an espionage classic. The first 5 sections of Spycraft recount remarkable stories of ingenuity, skill, and courage throughout the first 50 years of OTS history. Section 6 presents the doctrine of clandestine tradecraft from the perspective of espionage historian H. Keith Melton, and includes a chapter devoted to the revolutionary changes digital technology has brought to spy work. We wrestled from the beginning with the difficulties of when to present necessary explanations of the operational doctrine behind the technical topics that appear in the text. The impracticality of repeating explanations each time a technical topic appeared became quickly obvious. Lengthy footnotes also seemed more likely to distract rather than enlighten the reader. Therefore, we consolidated into Section 6 the 5 essential elements of clandestine operations used by every intelligence service, regardless of nationality or culture. These chapters, drawn from Melton's widely acclaimed lectures, writings, and exhibits, set out the basic principles underlying technical support to operations. These principles transcend any specific service and represent knowledge common and available to intelligence professionals and civilians alike from print, electronic, and film media. The individual chapters will aid the reader in understanding the basic philosophy and principles of assessment, cover, concealments, surveillance, and covert communications as practiced by professional services. Readers have the option of diving directly into the OTS story and the development of CIA's clandestine spy gear in chapters 1 through 19, or first immersing themselves with the doctrine and terminology of espionage operations presented in chapters 20 through 25. Spycraft combines the experiences and lore of the text based on the author's personal interviews and correspondence with nearly 100 engineers, technical operations officers, and case officers. We verified specific details to the extent possible by collaboration with public material and multiple primary sources. The names of several individuals quoted by the authors throughout the book are changed as a matter of security, cover, or requested privacy. We did not seek access to or use classified files. At times, the fallibility of memory may produce less than a perfectly accurate account of events many years past. In a few instances, we purposefully obscured facts to protect operational information or omitted sensitive details for the same reason. For example, the locations of operations, except those in Moscow, the former Soviet Union, and other denied area countries, are regionalized. Some operational terms and agency jargon that appear in works by other authors not bound by secrecy agreements have not been used at the request of the agency. Why do history? 2,000 years ago, Cicero observed, To be ignorant of what occurred before you is to remain always a child. For what is the worth of life unless it is woven into the lives of our ancestors by the records of history? A 20th century view, as expressed by G.K. Chesterton, is, in not knowing